content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 13th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have a huge American bald eagle in the foreground. Under one of his feet, he's got pinned down a white dove. The dove is clearly dead and bloodied. On the ground behind the eagle is an upside-down MAGA ball cap. And in the background is total destruction. City bombed out. Fires burning, smoke everywhere. The headline is America at War, Trump's decision to attack Iran. That comes up several places, including our first main story. We will start there. U.S. war with Iran widens across the Middle East. What happened? President Trump gave conflicting justifications this week for launching a war against Iran as the U.S. and Israel intensified their aerial bombardment of the Islamic Republic and Iranian missiles and drones slammed into targets across the Middle East. Operation Epic Fury began last week with coordinated U.S.-Israeli strikes on military and government sites across Iran. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was killed in a decapitation strike on a compound in Tehran. Another raid killed a dozen top Iranian defense officials as they gathered nearby for a meeting. More than 1,000 Iranian civilians were reported killed as the week went to press, including at least 175 people, many of them young students, in a missile strike on a girls' elementary school in Minab. At least six U.S. troops were killed when an Iranian drone hit their makeshift operations center in Kuwait. Trump, who refused to rule out sending ground troops into Iran, said the offensive was just starting and warned more U.S. casualties were likely. "That's the way it is," he said. Congressional Democrats assailed Trump for dragging the U.S. into a potential quagmire. "It's dangerous, unnecessary, and idiotic," said Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. The State Department shuttered embassies across the Middle East and ordered Americans to evacuate as Iranian drones and missiles rained down on U.S. regional allies. Oil and natural gas facilities, U.S. bases and consulates, airports, luxury hotels, and residential buildings were all hit. At least 11 Israelis and 9 people in Gulf states were killed, some of whom died after being hit by falling debris from intercepted missiles. In a video released as the operation started, Trump urged Iranians to rise up and take over your government, calling it probably your only chance in generations. In a call with reporters soon after, he said the war's goal was freedom for the people. But he later gave numerous conflicting reasons for attacking Iran, including ending the country's nuclear program, preempting an imminent attack, and defeating an evil ideology. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said America's hand was forced by a planned Israeli attack. Trump then said the opposite was true. Asked whom he wanted to lead Iran, Trump said he wasn't sure and acknowledged any new rulers could be as bad as the old ones. "Most of the people we had in mind are dead," he said. Khamenei's son, the hardline cleric Mojtaba Khamenei, is widely expected to replace his father. What the editorial said. Trump has launched a fateful war of choice, said the Financial Times, and he's done it with utter disregard for international law and only the sketchiest attempts to justify the assault to the American people and the world. Few Iranians will mourn Khamenei, whose brutal regime impoverished its people and exported militancy abroad, but his demise has opened a Pandora's box. Trump may learn, as other presidents have, that it's easy to start a war in the Middle East, but much harder to end it. This is a necessary act of deterrence against a global threat, said the Wall Street Journal. Yes, it carries risks, but it could reshape the Middle East for the better. Trump gave Khamenei ample chance to strike a deal to end his nuclear weapons program and avoid strikes, and he refused. Accused of starting a needless war, Trump is actually hitting back at a regime that's been waging war against the U.S., Israel, and the West for decades. What the columnist said, there's no reason to think this war is necessary, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Trump claimed last summer to have totally obliterated Iran's nuclear program. Now he claims it's an imminent threat, despite no evidence Iran has resumed enrichment, nor is there evidence it's rapidly developing ballistic missiles that can reach the U.S., as Trump insisted. And if the goal is regime change, how will that work without ground troops? We're talking about a deeply entrenched regime in a country of 93 million. Overthrowing it with aerial attacks is probably impossible. Facing overwhelming firepower, Iran has a basic strategy, said Stephen Erlanger in the New York Times. Inflict enough pain to drive up the cost of the war and get Trump to stand down. It aims to enlarge the battlefield across the Gulf, disrupting economies, shutting down shipping, and damaging oil and gas infrastructure. Meanwhile, the elite Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is not about to go quietly, said Jim Garrity in National Review. It has up to 190,000 members who have no place to retreat and recognize that this is now a fight to the death. Even if the regime falls, it won't necessarily produce stability, let alone democracy, said Rahan Menon and Daniel R. DePetris in The Guardian. The state collapse wrought by U.S. interventions in Iraq and Libya resulted in prolonged anarchy, refugee flows, and the spread of terrorism across borders. Iran is larger and more populous than those countries, with diverse ethnic and political constituencies. A power vacuum could yield turmoil that would make our previous Mideast misadventures look tame. We're now at war with Iran, and nobody really knows why, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. Not even Trump. Are we defusing a threat? Aiding an oppressed populace? Trying to effect regime change? It is literally impossible to say. This isn't how democracies operate, but how dictators make war on whims. The result is an open-ended conflict with no clearly defined objective or exit strategy, and a million different ways it could go wrong. The controversy of the week. Iran. Will MAGA forgive Trump's betrayal? President Trump's war in Iran is barely a week old, and MAGA already hates it, said Will Somner in The Bulwark. This should not be surprising. From the first days of his 2016 campaign, the central pillar of Trump's isolationist America First agenda was a pledge to waste no more blood and treasure on new wars of choice, and to stop trying to topple, in his own words, foreign regimes that we know nothing about. Now that the self-declared president of peace has done precisely that in Iran, the mood within MAGA is dour. Podcaster Tucker Carlson denounced the war as absolutely disgusting and evil, accusing Israel of having duped the administration into doing its Middle Eastern dirty work. Former House member Marjorie Taylor Greene accused Trump of betrayal. Other MAGA stalwarts, including former Fox News personality Megyn Kelly, commentator Matt Walsh, and misogynist influencer Andrew Tate, are also speaking out. For now, dissent is a minority position among Republicans, 77% of whom say they support the war, numbers that somewhat support Trump's boast that MAGA is Trump and MAGA loves what I'm doing. But it has only been a week, said Emma Ashford in Foreign Policy. With midterms looming and 59% of Americans already opposed to the war, Trump has no margin for error. He has rolled the dice and bet his presidency that this will be a short, successful war, not another disastrous Middle East quagmire. Quagmires are off the table, said Mark A. Thiessen in the Washington Post. When Trump promised no new foreign wars, he meant he wouldn't send U.S. boots into foreign hotspots for multi-year nation-building exercises, such as we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. Iran will be more like his January raid on Venezuela, a brief but overwhelming action to decapitate a hostile regime involving few, if any, ground troops. What happens after that will be up to the Iranian people. Trump has not forgotten the lessons of Iraq, said Niall Ferguson in the Free Press, and there will be no attempt to build a Western-style democracy. The one thing I can confidently promise about war with Iran, it will not last long. That's not how wars work, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic. In a region this complex and volatile, there are countless ways the conflict could careen out of control and require an infusion of U.S. ground troops, something Trump says he doesn't have the yips about. Yes, it would be very like Trump to simply declare victory and walk away from the carnage in time to mend fences with MAGA and have voters forget about Iran before the midterms. But that will be hard if regional allies are bogged down in wars with Iran and its proxies, or if a regime even more dangerous than the one we're trying to destroy arises in Tehran. What happens next will shape the right for years to come, said David M. Drucker in Bloomberg. Many observers misidentify a significant chunk of the MAGA base as isolationist, when what it really is really opposed to is losing. For them, bombing Tehran and a muscular show of American power is fine. Occupying it would be another matter entirely. Still, cracks in the MAGA coalition are showing, and if the war drags on and more America First voters bail, it may become impossible for the next Republican nominee to take the baton from Trump and win the White House. That's something for Trump's most likely successors, Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to think about. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for awful. After Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said Americans can blunt the impact of rising grocery prices by swapping porterhouse steak for liver or the cheaper cuts of steak that are very, very affordable. It's a good week for self-segregation. After Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, paid $170 million for a partially built mega mansion, which boasts a hair salon, massage room, and 1,500-gallon aquarium on Miami's exclusive Indian Creek Island. Just three doors down from a compound owned by fellow tech billionaire Jeff Bezos. It was a good week for Highlanders. After Scottish soccer fans were granted approval to take sporrans, the leather or fur pouches traditionally worn over a kilt, into stadiums at this summer's U.S.-Mexico-Canada World Cup. Our sporrans will contain our match tickets and hope, said Van Hamish husband. That's all we want to smuggle into the stadiums. But it was a bad week for armchair theology. After White House border czar Tom Homan said Pope Leo XIV's criticism of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown stemmed from the pontiff's shaky grasp of Catholic doctrine. I'd be happy to sit down and explain to him what he's missing, offered Homan, who cited his credentials as a lifelong Catholic. It's a bad week for timing. After FBI Director Kash Patel fired a dozen agents from an FBI counterintelligence team monitoring Iran-linked terrorist groups just days before the U.S. went to war with Iran, the agents were axed for their involvement in a Biden-era investigation of President Trump. And finally, it was a bad week for the 19th hole. After state inspectors issued five health code violations against Trump National Golf Club in Westchester County, New York, In addition to insect and rodent activity, the inspectors cited the club for dirty surfaces and missing or inadequate sneeze guards. The briefing this week, the K-shaped economy. What happens when only the richest reap the benefits of economic growth? What is a K-shaped economy? It's a term used by a growing number of economists to describe the two-lane scenario they see playing out in the U.S., in which higher-income households on the upward arm of the K see their wealth increase while lower income families are squeezed by stagnating incomes and rising prices. At a broad level, the economy appears healthy, with unemployment hovering at just over 4%, inflation edging down from a pandemic era peak of 9.1% to about 2.5%, and stock markets hitting record highs. President Trump says Americans are living in a golden age, but many don't feel it. Most industries are in a hiring freeze. Borrowing costs remain high. Inflation remains above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. And because the top 10% of Americans own 87% of stocks, few people have directly benefited from soaring share prices. Fed data shows the share of wealth held by the richest 1% hit nearly 32% last year, the highest since records began in 1989. The worry with income inequality is not just where we stand now, said Beth Ann Bovino, chief economist at U.S. Bank, but also whether ongoing developments will worsen the situation. When did this start? Rising wealth inequality has been a fact of American life since the 1980s. But it accelerated sharply during the COVID-induced 2020 recession, when white-collar professionals remained employed and worked from home, saving money that would have been spent on commuting, vacations, and more, while mass layoffs at restaurants, hotels, and factories pushed unemployment to 15%. Inequality shrank somewhat when the economy reopened and demand surged, with many now short-staffed companies lifting pay for traditionally low-income jobs. In 2023 and 2024, inflation-adjusted wages for the bottom quarter of workers climbed at 3.9% a year, outpacing the top quarter's 3.1%. We had that kind of two-tier period where the bottom was catching up, said Dario Perkins, an economist at consultancy T.S. Lombard. Since then, the economy has cooled down again. Hiring has dropped over the past year, as have pay hikes for some. After-tax wage growth ticked up 4% year-on-year for higher-income households, according to New Bank of America report, but climbed just over 2% for middle-income families and 1.4% for lower-income families. For many in the middle and lower tiers, simply staying afloat now feels like a struggle. Why is that? It's partly because the cost of many essentials has climbed faster than wages, a fact not reflected in headline inflation figures. Prices are collectively up about 25% since 2020, but residential electricity rates are more than 30% higher on average than in 2020, and up by more than 100% for some who live near power-hungry AI data centers. National home prices rocketed 55% in that period, with the median house price hitting $432,700 in mid-2025, which has boosted the wealth of those who own property, but put home ownership out of reach for many who don't. The cost of owning a car, everything from sticker price to maintenance to insurance, has accelerated more than 40%, while groceries are up 30%. About a quarter of Americans today live paycheck to paycheck, spending more than 95% of their income on necessities. The people claiming prices are lower are not actually buying their own groceries, said Vanessa Jones, a nurse in Davenport, Iowa, who works two jobs and recently declared bankruptcy after being swamped with medical bills following a cancer diagnosis. As the divide between the wealthy and lower-income consumers grows, many businesses are rethinking their target audience. What are companies doing? Some are refocusing on premium products. It's a sensible shift considering that a recent Moody's Analytics report found the top 10% of earners, those making at least $251,000 a year, account for just over 49% of consumer spending, up from 43% in 2020. Spending on luxury fashion climbed 8% year-on-year in 2025, and sales of first and business class tickets are now propelling revenue and profit for Delta Airlines, CEO Ed Bastian said in October. Lower-end consumers, he added, are clearly struggling. Coca-Cola announced in an analyst call late last year that its earnings were being boosted by high-end brands such as Smartwater. Walmart, meanwhile, is pitching itself as the store of choice for overstretched Americans. In November, then-CEO Doug McMillon told analysts that upper- and middle-income households are driving our growth, a sign that Whole Foods or Target shoppers are increasingly trading down and seeking bargains at discount retailers. Is the K-shaped economy here to stay? Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, thinks so. This is not a cyclical or temporary phenomenon, he said. It's structural. Analysts worry that the boom in artificial intelligence could deepen the divide, with a soaring stock of firms such as AI chip maker NVIDIA benefiting a small sliver of the population but not generating many jobs. What we see at the very top is an economy that is sort of self-contained, said Peter Atwater, an economist at the College of William and Mary, between AI, the stock market, the experiences of the wealthy. Then there's the fear that AI could wipe out many entry-level and white-collar jobs, which would supercharge inequality. An economy based only on top earners, many experts agree, is not sustainable. If layoffs intensify and middle and lower income Americans cut back spending, the earning of big tech firms, which make up about 32% of the S&P 500's value, would sink. You're talking about the bottom of the K essentially pulling down the top, said Perkins. There's also the risk of political unrest, which has accompanied previous periods of dizzying technological change and income stratification. In a K-shaped system, the top gets insulated enough to become careless, said venture capitalist John Tannenbaum, while the bottom gets desperate enough to become combustible. And we'll read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Sleepwalking into an autocracy. As Adolf Hitler and the Nazis rose to power in the 1930s, said historian Ian Baruma, most Germans looked away, pretending to see nothing, and carried on with their lives. Why? My study of autocratic regimes has found that their assaults on the rule of law and morality are incremental. Today's outrage is tomorrow's normal. People adapt and get used to it. Now, Donald Trump is not Hitler, and we are nowhere near the disastrous circumstances of Germans in the 1930s. But Trump's defenders and minimizers have succumbed to a similar form of self-deception. When Trump tried to stage a violent coup to overturn the 2020 election, it became clear he was a lawless authoritarian. Since he was reelected, one red line after another has been crossed. Undocumented immigrants are being rounded up like animals. Dissident citizens have been gunned down and called domestic terrorists. Universities, news organizations, and law firms are being bullied and blackmailed. Trump and his cronies have pocketed billions. What was unthinkable only yesterday, we now take in stride, hoping it won't personally affect us. But the power grab is accelerating. Unless Americans shed their passivity, we should prepare for the worst. For seniors, vaccines have extra benefits. America's children aren't the only ones to suffer from Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s multi-front war on vaccines, said Donald G. McNeil Jr. His delusional anti-science crusade also poses a major threat to Americans over 65. The older you get, the more likely it is that common infections can cascade into more severe illnesses and death. Propping up your fading immune system with vaccines can make our declining years longer and happier. This is why we now have a smorgasbord of adult immunizations against shingles, the flu, pneumococcal disease, RSV, and COVID, most of which can be transmitted from unvaccinated kids to the elderly. Vaccines don't just reduce the risk of death. By warding off viral damage in the body, new studies have found, they have marvelous side effects. Getting two doses of the shingles vaccine made older people 50% less likely to get a dementia diagnosis within 3 years. COVID shots significantly reduce seniors' risk of developing type 2 diabetes. While RSV vaccines are 80% effective at preventing blood clots that can lead to heart attacks and strokes. In his relentless undermining of vaccines, Kennedy is working to make our lives shorter and harder. This column comes from Afghanistan, where half the population is locked away. The Taliban want everyone to think they've joined the modern world, said the Times of India. Desperate for investment, they are trying to shed their brutal reputation by fielding a cricket team and inviting YouTubers to promote tourism. But there's no hiding that they have created a horror chamber for Afghan women. Girls and women are banned from schools and nearly all jobs. Covered head to toe in black if they do venture out, they have been entirely erased from public life. Recently, the Taliban actually made women's plight worse by issuing a penal code that explicitly allows men to beat their wives and daughters as long as they don't cause broken bones or open wounds. The penalty for drawing blood is 15 days in jail, less than the punishment for abusing an animal. A woman who visits her father's house without her husband's permission can get 3 months in prison. The Taliban seems to believe they can revive Afghanistan's economy and build a functioning society without the participation of women. But this is utterly impossible. Even Saudi Arabia has finally recognized this obvious truth and has been quietly dismantling its own system of gender apartheid. With their new penal code, the Taliban 2.0 show they are just as brutish as their earlier avatar, and they're taking their country to a dark place. The last word, our feature article, clues or clickbait. Self-declared sleuths have inserted themselves into the search for Savannah Guthrie's mother, said Elena Demopoulos in The Guardian, compromising the investigation for online clout. On the 10th day of the search for Nancy Guthrie, reporters camped outside of the missing woman's home noticed a strange man strut right up to the front door. It had been more than a week since the mother of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie had disappeared, and authorities had just announced they had a new lead from ring footage of what looked like a potential subject attempting to tamper with the doorbell camera on the morning of her disappearance. So now who was this unknown person, clad in a gray top and black pants, carrying a large black bag and striding to the door? It was a Domino's delivery driver. Never seen something quite like this, local ABC reporter Ford Hatchett wrote on X. Delivery was for an independent journalist out here who is live streaming. A viewer ordered it for him. JLR Investigates is the name of the YouTube channel run by Jonathan Lee Riches, who describes himself as a fearless investigator and has more than 540,000 subscribers who watch his dispatches from outside Guthrie's Tucson home. We can't believe we have to say this, but media on scene, please do not order food delivery to a crime scene address, the Pima County Sheriff's Department wrote in a statement. This interferes with an active investigation. Please also respect private property laws. National media has descended on crime scenes since the dawn of tabloids more than 100 years ago. The modern media circus only became more invasive with the advent of the 24/7 news cycle. The Nancy Guthrie investigation is no different. But this time, an even more meddling type of reporter has come to define the investigation. The true crime streamer. Self-declared sleuths like Riches have inserted themselves into the investigation, broadcasting their videos to a sizable audience. He posts streams with titles like Breaking, Manhunt, Nancy Guthrie Kidnapping, Live. But once you click through, you mostly see Riches simply sitting in his car. On day 19 of the investigation, he was at one point documenting a police shift change at the scene of the crime. Bathroom break, he narrated to his 29,000 viewers. Riches does try to offer more than just dry footage of the house's exterior. He has investigated tips such as an unrelated car tow and hospital airlift, as if these leads might go somewhere. Followers might appreciate Rich's tenacity, but the false tips breed misinformation. State Representative Alma Hernandez slammed wannabe reporters who have now caused more harm than good to this entire situation and put this serious case in jeopardy. Before his true crime pivot, Riches spent time in jail for wire fraud. He made headlines in 2012 for driving to Connecticut in the wake of the Sandy Hook tragedy, posing as the elementary school shooter's uncle. He is known for his prolific filing of absurd lawsuits. The San Francisco Chronicle estimated more than 4,000 by 2024, including one against the Kardashian family for participating in Al-Qaeda training. He once filed a phony lawsuit against former Representative Gabrielle Giffords, posing as the man who shot her and killed six people in 2011. He even attempted to sue the Guinness Book of World Records for dubbing him the world's most litigious person. But representatives for Guinness said they did not have that record category. The suit was later dismissed. Riches did not respond to a request for comment. He told the Arizona Republic that the fake lawsuit against Giffords was a joke he filed to entertain himself in prison and was in bad taste. For this, he would be sentenced to 5 years probation on charge of making false statements. Riches is one of a handful of live streamers who have relocated to Tucson. Jimmy Williams, a former construction worker turned full-time streamer, spends up to 6 hours sitting in a lawn chair outside the Guthrie family home. Williams, who streams on his channel Dolly Vision, told an Australian reporter his trips are totally funded by viewer donations. The plane tickets, the hotels, all come courtesy of his audience. In one video, Williams reported on shocking chaos at the scene of the crime, which ended up being a fight the streamer had with a neighbor over parking. As well as the streamers, there are such figures as Megyn Kelly getting involved. Kelly used to be part of the institutionalized media. After her lengthy stint at Fox News, she was briefly Savannah Guthrie's colleague on the Today Show. Now she's an independent journalist, self-producing a daily talk show and reporting on unverified online theories about the Guthries, although she did not descend on their home. On her show, she floated an eerie social media theory about Savannah Guthrie's plea to her mother's captors. Kelly discussed a video message in which Savannah Guthrie spoke of her mother's kindness and then said, "Talk to her, and you'll see. The line mirrors a quote from the horror film The Silence of the Lambs, where a deranged serial killer kidnaps a senator's daughter. In the movie, the senator releases a similar statement using the same phrase. As Kelly put it, the choice of words could be completely coincidental, or it might not be. Last month, after Riches and others suggested Guthrie family members might be responsible for the crime, and Kelly said she wouldn't rule the family out as suspects, Sheriff Chris Nanos refuted the allegation, writing, "The family has been nothing but cooperative and gracious and are victims in this case. To suggest otherwise is not only wrong, it is cruel. Please, I'm begging you, the media, to honor your professionalism and report with some sense of compassion and professionalism." Bonanno's statement is directed toward an inherently unprofessional media. Most of these true crime streamers lack any streaming or good reporting judgment. In the past, they might have covered solved murders or decades-old cold cases, not breaking news. "That's changed in recent years," said Kate Winkler Dawson, a producer and senior lecturer in broadcast journalism at University of Texas at Austin. "I first noticed it with Gabby Petito," said Dawson, referring to the vlogger who was killed by her boyfriend while the pair documented their van life through the American West. It took almost a month for authorities to discover Petito's body. "There was a clear and present danger," Dawson said. "Where is she?" "There is an entitlement from some folks online who don't feel like they're getting enough information." Petito's missing van was discovered thanks to dash cam video from another YouTuber, which to some viewers validated their involvement in the case. It perpetuates the belief that folks online hold the key to breaking cases. "And sometimes they do," Dawson said. "But most of the time, it really slows down the case and is unhelpful." Mandy Matney was a newspaper journalist in South Carolina who struck true crime podcast gold while covering the crimes of Alex Murdaugh, a lawyer who was found guilty of killing his wife and son. The show, Murdaugh Murders Podcast, doggedly followed the police investigation and subsequent trial, becoming the number one podcast on Apple in 2021, and the basis for a Hulu series starring Jason Clarke and Patricia Arquette. Matney says she was caught in the middle as a journalist turned social media star. She said that during her reporting, she found herself surrounded by true crime influencers. "We weren't really competing at all with legacy media for scoops," Matney said. "We were competing with TikTokers and content creators who were just making up news and publishing very baseless tips." It takes years of learning how to vet information as a journalist and really falling on your face to learn how to properly source stories and decide what information the public needs to hear. After the killing of Rob and Michelle Reiner in their home in the affluent Brentwood neighborhood of Los Angeles, and police charging their son Nick with first-degree murder, reports surfaced of influencers showing up at the scene in hopes of filming macabre on-the-scene videos. One streamer wore a Burger King hat and yelled racial slurs at reporters. Two others drove by filming for their audience while blasting music from their car. "One of the biggest problems with this behavior is the sentiment behind it," said Dawson. "It's not to help the case or to inform people. It's clickbait, a way to make money and stay relevant in the true crime world." Jennifer Youngblood streams under the handle J is for Justice, which is also the name of her true crime podcast. Youngblood, who is 52 and lives in Clearwater, Florida, spent most of her career in home health care and hospice work. She now fully supports herself through true crime. She started streaming in 2018, documenting the case of Christopher Lee Watts, a Colorado man who killed his pregnant wife and two children. She met Riches, the Guthrie streamer, in Facebook groups created to follow various cases. Youngblood is now in Tucson, where she's mostly shadowing Riches and making a few videos of her own about Guthrie. She says he goes out with his tripod, two phones, and a fan in case his phones overheat. She does not find the presence of streamers or their lack of standards problematic. I think anybody has the right to report on anything they want, Youngblood said. The viewers know that Jonathan is not in the know. They know he's not an investigator. They know he's not a cop. I think people are intrigued by watching every step of the way. Youngblood said that Guthrie's neighbors are appreciative of Rich's. There's been so many neighbors that have come up and said, "We're so happy you're here. We're watching you. We want to see what's going on. We're not kept in the loop from the police." She believes the mainstream media is bewildered by Rich's popularity and may be feeling a bit of professional jealousy, too. He's getting millions of views, and that's what's got their attention, she said. She says she knows all about Rich's history of wire fraud and phony lawsuits. It does not bother her. Everyone wants to talk about his felony background and the things he went through. But I think that people should be celebrated for changing their life and doing good things, she said. She trusts him to be accurate, saying, "I think his record speaks for itself." And what about when streamers do get things wrong? I think that any time you have a case of this magnitude, you have misinformation, regardless if there's people streaming or not, Youngblood said. You have forums like X and Reddit. I think that social media itself is the bearer of misinformation. Mainstream journalists are mostly appalled by attitudes like Youngblood's. One of the unfortunate things is that the public may sort of confuse these vultures in their ghoulish questions and prying with more mainstream legitimate news outlets, said Mark Feldstein, who spent 20 years as an on-air investigative correspondent at CNN and ABC News and is now the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. They're just winging it, making it up as they go along. And so it kind of deflates the currency for all journalists. This was adapted from an article that first appeared in The Guardian. Get a couple of the health and science short pieces today. Writing that dates to the Stone Age. Marks that humans carved into tools and figurines over 40,000 years ago could be an ancient form of proto-writing, a new study has found. Researchers analyzed close to 3,000 geometric symbols, including crosses, dots, notches, and lines on 260 artifacts made of ivory, bone, and antler from the Swabian Alps in southwestern Germany. Using computer-assisted methods, the team found that carvings showed some same level of complexity and information density as proto-cuneiform script, which arose in Mesopotamia about 5,300 years ago and is considered the first known writing system. They are very similar, in fact, indistinguishable, co-author Christian Bentz, a computational linguist at Sarlen University, tells CNN.com. This was really surprising. The signs tend to occur in patterns, such as line, 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 or cross, 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 which is uncommon in spoken language. And there appears to be logic to the symbol selection. Crosses appear on animal figurines and tools, but never on human figurines, suggesting some kind of taboo or convention. While it's impossible to interpret the individual signs made by a people who spoke a language lost to time, it seems clear the marks carried meanings beyond just decoration. The mental capacity to transform information into codes is much older than we thought, said co-author Uwe Duchowicz in the Museum of Prehistory and Early History in Berlin. That's the drastic change that our study shows. The origins of the eye. How could something as complex as an eye possibly evolve through random mutation? The question famously tormented Charles Darwin and creationist have cited the eye as proof of intelligent design. Yet a new study says the answer is relatively simple, reports the New York Times. It all started with a patch of light-sensitive cells in ancient invertebrates. The researchers hypothesized that 560 million years ago, creatures that lived in mud on the ocean floor possessed a single patch of light-sensitive cells on top of their heads to help track the cycle of day and night and determine up or down. As their descendants left their burrows and began swimming, the cell patch could have developed cup-shaped depressions to be sensitive to light direction. Fish still retain a vestige of what was likely that ancestral eye in the form of a pineal gland on the top of the head. Over millions of years, the prototinas migrated to the sides of the head, producing depth and field so animals could sense distances as they swam. While scientists can't be sure this is how evolution proceeded, said neurobiologist Tom Baden, what we've done is we provided a plausible set of steps that got us here. Are microplastics causing cancer? Researchers have found microplastics inside prostate cancer tumors, raising questions whether these now ubiquitous particles play a role in the disease. In a small study of 10 men, scientists compared samples from prostate tumor tissue with non-cancerous tissues from the same prostate. They found that the cancerous tissue contained an average of 2.5 times more plastic than the non-cancerous, about 40 micrograms of plastic per gram of tissue. That was very surprising and concerning, lead author Stacy Loeb, a urologist at NYU Langone Health, tells NBC News. This is definitely something we're going to continue to study further with more cases, because similar studies in microplastics in humans have been criticized for possibly introducing microplastic contamination in the lab process. The study authors were rigorous in eliminating plastic from their methods. If anything, this might have been overly conservative, Loeb said. Over the past decade, cases of late-stage prostate cancer have shot up more than 6% in men over 55. And we may have time for a couple of Talking Points articles. We'll start with Cuba. Next on the regime change agenda. Now that he's removed the leaders of Iran and Venezuela, Donald Trump is eyeing his next target, Cuba, said Vivian Salama in The Atlantic. The president told reporters last week he may launch a friendly takeover of the communist nation, an American foe since its 1959 communist revolution. Trump reportedly has deputized Secretary of State Marco Rubio to make a deal with Raul Guillermo Rodriguez Castro, a leading Cuban power broker and grandson of the former president Raul Castro. Rubio, a descendant of anti-Castro Cuban refugees, said in recent interviews that the country has no economy and needs to change. To ramp up the pressure, Trump has cut off the island's access to Venezuelan oil and imposed a near-total trade blockade that human rights experts call an extreme form of unilateral economic coercion. The game might be up for a Castro government, said Mauricio de Miranda Porondo in the New York Times. After decades of heavy-handed repression and centralized control by incompetent socialist leaders, the country is no longer capable of producing the basic goods it needs and must import most of its food. The acute fuel shortages have caused power outages that can last for hours or even days. Hospitals don't have medicine or equipment to treat their patients. Buying food means waiting in long lines and paying exorbitant prices. With Cuba caught in a downward spiral, even the social contract, free, high-quality health care and education that sustained the regime for years, is crumbling. Still, don't put your money on the regime's imminent demise, said James Bloodworth in Foreign Policy. The government's totalitarian repression machine remains intact. The most of the young, able-bodied Cubans who would be needed for a rebellion have fled the country. Left behind is a rapidly aging population that has been trained into hopeless passivity. Cuba's communist dictatorship has only one goal, said Carlos Iyer in the Washington Post. Stay in power, no matter the cost. So it's hard to imagine the regime making a deal with Trump or a democracy taking root there. Unlike Venezuela, Cuba has no oil to fund the massive reconstruction that the island desperately needs. We in the Cuban exile community want to see the end of communist rule, but fear the potential for chaos, violence, disappointment. This is not a time for optimism. Not yet. Health. An influencer for Surgeon General? The competition is fierce, but Casey Means may be President Trump's weirdest nomination so far, said Chris Trowell in The Hill. Appearing before a Senate committee last week, Trump's pick for Surgeon General was grilled on why she should be confirmed as America's top doctor, even though she's not a doctor. Not a practicing one, anyway. A graduate of Stanford's medical school, she dropped out of her residency in 2018 to become a wellness influencer and entrepreneur, helping launch Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again movement. Meanwhile, Means, 38, has written gushingly about tripping on hallucinogenic mushrooms. I felt myself as part of an infinite and unbroken series of cosmic nesting dolls, and encouraged followers to try the illegal drug. She has made hundreds of thousands of dollars hawking dubious supplements and encouraged people to optimize their health with a glucose monitoring device sold by a company she co-founded. Means has also pushed vaccine skepticism, claiming that life-saving shots are in fact harming children. If the Senate cares at all about the nation's health, it will reject this unsuited, unqualified, and unlicensed quack. After her Senate hearing, Means kept her most eccentric wellness beliefs largely in check, said Tom Bartlett in The Atlantic. She didn't praise psychedelics or endorse raw milk, as she is normally wont to do. She did not rail against tap water or conventionally grown food, and insisted that her past talk about the horrifying health risks of hormonal birth control referred only to the risk of clotting for a small subset of women. Means is still a crank, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. When pressed by senators, she equivocated on the disproven link between vaccines and autism, and dodged when asked if she'd encourage parents to get their children vaccinated against measles. The Surgeon General is supposed to provide Americans with the best scientific advice on health and illness, something Means seems utterly incapable of doing. In her bid to win over skeptical lawmakers, Means spouted all sorts of soothing things about the need for choice and freedom in medicine, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. But the real goal of Kennedy, Means, and the MAHA crowd is not to provide people with more choices, but to use the power of government to force different choices. This group of crazy is dismantling our public health institutions and research centers and demolishing trust in medicine. When they're done, we'll be presented with a choice on how to treat our ailments, with raw milk, ivermectin, or the supplements that have made Means rich. And a few of the shorter notes. More people left the U.S. than immigrated to it last year for the first time since 1935. The trend is being driven by increased deportations and by record numbers of Americans moving abroad. Up to 9 million Americans are now expatriates, and at least 180,000 joined their ranks last year, according to an analysis of data from 15 countries. Pollution from U.S. power plants climbed last year as President Trump pushed for coal use and wound down Biden-era regulations. Emissions of sulfur dioxide from power stacks, which fell by an average of 12.5% a year for the past two decades, were up by 18%, nitrogen oxide by 7%, and carbon dioxide by 4%. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is spending $270 million on luxury jets. The department bought two Gulfstream G700 jets in October for $200 million and now plans to buy at least a leased Boeing 737 for $70 million. Homeland Security said the 737, which has space for 18 passengers and boasts a bar and bedroom, would be used for deportations and executive travel. The Trump administration plans to process 4,500 applications a month for refugee status from white South Africans, despite previously setting a cap of 7,500 applications from all countries combined for fiscal year 2026. On the poll watch, Israel's overall favorable rating has declined to 46%. Nearing a historical low. 57% of Americans favor an independent Palestinian state, the highest percentage since 2003. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Henry David Thoreau, who says, "I believe that there is a subtle magnetism in nature, which, if we unconsciously yield to it, will direct us aright." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.